for oral argument in In re Connell Living Trust, case 73837. Are counsel ready to proceed? Please approach then and let the clerk know how much time, if any, you want to reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you. If I may reserve 3 minutes. May it please the court. The appellant Eleanor Ahern seeks a reversal of the compensatory and punitive judgments and a remand to the district court for a new evidentiary hearing on the daughter's claims for compensatory damages and, if warranted, punitive damages, where Ms. Ahern can be represented by counsel and where NRS 42005 is appropriately followed by the district court. To give the court a roadmap for where I'd like to go this morning, I submit that reversal and remand is appropriate for three primary reasons, two of which have to do with the punitive judgment, the other has to do with the motion to continue. First, the district court failed to conduct a subsequent proceeding in violation of NRS 42.005 subsection 3 to determine the amount of punitive damages after it found that punitive damage would be assessed. Second, the amount of and basis for the punitive award was arbitrary and does not pass constitutional muster and the guideposts that both this court and the United States Supreme Court have articulated. And third, because the district court abused its discretion when it denied Ms. Ahern's oral motion to continue the hearing, which was made right before the hearing and one day before the court granted her request to have the trustee pay for her legal defense. By statute, Nevada requires the liability determination for punitive damages against the defendant be bifurcated from the assessment of the amount of punitive damages, if any, to be awarded. That's not my words. That's this court's words from the Wyeth v. Rout case in 2010. And that did not occur in this case.
Why does it matter when it's a bench trial rather than a jury trial?
Yeah, that's a good question, Your Honor, and I can answer it this way. First, there's nothing to distinguish a bench trial versus a jury trial in the statute itself. And in this court, in Betzinger, declined to look at anything other than the plain meaning of the statute, especially with respect to subsection 3. And there's two practical reasons that I can think of off the top of my head for why you would still need a bifurcated proceeding. One is that under subsection 4, I believe, to introduce evidence of financial condition and ability to pay, you first have to have the initial proceeding. It's expressly stated in the statute that you can't introduce evidence of the financial condition until the subsequent proceeding. The second reason, Your Honor, is that from a judicial economy perspective, it wouldn't make sense for a litigant to prepare for trial and to prepare for defending a punitive damage claim if he knew, based on the statute, that he wouldn't have to introduce that evidence unless and until there was a finding that punitive damages would have to be assessed.
But subsequent doesn't give a specific amount of time. I mean, in a bench trial, you could make the finding and then immediately say, now we're convened in the punitive damages proceeding, right?
And I agree, Your Honor. Subsequent proceeding is not defined by the statute, and there's no case law that tries to define what that means. But in this case, it's undisputed that there was no subsequent proceeding. There was one proceeding, the second evidentiary hearing, where it was determined the amount of compensatory damages, whether punitive damages ought to be assessed, and the amount of punitive damages. And that just runs afoul of the statute if the court follows the plain meaning, which under stare decisis it would if it follows Betzinger.
Yeah, I looked at some of the other state statutes on this because it's kind of a puzzle what Nevada was doing with it. And there are statutes elsewhere that limit these kinds of bifurcated proceedings to jury trials, but ours does not. It seems on its face to apply to all kinds of trials.
And I agree, Your Honor, and I think that from a practical perspective, it could make sense, especially when it's a bench trial and you've got a judge being the fact finder, to do it at once. But that's not our statute, and until the legislature amends that's what we got to do.
Do you link the requirement of a bifurcated proceeding in any way? As I was thinking about this case, it goes into the motion to continue shortly before trial. She proceeds without counsel. Does it tie into the fact that had she known she was about to be assessed with punitive damages in an untold amount, that was something that might have weighed in the continuance decision? Do you tie those up at all?
I do, Your Honor. Here's why. And this speaks to our response to the harmless error, okay? The reality of the situation is if the court followed the statute and set a subsequent hearing, we know that at least the day before that hearing, the court ordered upon Ms. Ahern's ex parte request that fees be paid to provide money for her defense. So if that actually happened in this case, if the subsequent proceeding were set and were convened, there's a very good chance that Mr. Semenza or another attorney for Ms. Ahern could have represented her in that proceeding and defended the punitive
bench trial. But conversely, if you take Justice Kedish's point and say, well, subsequent in the bench trial can be okay, we're done, I find punitive damage liability, now let's have the subsequent hearing on amount, we know that Mr. Semenza was disinclined to undertake representation on such short notice. So if that had played out that way, the flip is also true, I guess.
That's true, but the bottom line is we don't know. And in this situation where, given the facts of this case, where there were serious claims for not only compensatory but punitive damages, the fact that we had a statute that everyone's entitled to rely on that has a clear and plain meaning, that should have been granted. And you're right, the court could have said, well, we're going to convene this punitive damage claim next day, and Mr. Semenza could say, I still don't have enough time, but we don't know that. And I think that would be speculative.
Back in the day when, before they had this statute, we would argue that you shouldn't even get discovery into financial net worth until liability for punitive damages had been imposed. Is that currently the practice, or is that normally undertaken in discovery whenever there's a viable punitive damage claim?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that I think this was maybe in the Wyeth case. I'm not sure, but I know that it's been discussed by this court before, is that because the statute is the way it is, an ability to pay a punitive damage claim is essentially irrelevant until you first get the finding that punitive damages ought to be assessed. Then, under the statute, I can point to it, but it's NRS 005 subsection 4, I think, where it says that once you have that finding, then the defendant can introduce evidence of his financial condition to pay a judgment in that subsequent hearing.
There was a discovery cutoff in this case, wasn't there, or was there?
You know, it's murky. I'm not sure. What I know is that I didn't have the benefit of being in the lower court, but what I do know is that the evidence that was introduced in this evidentiary hearing was only the testimony of Mr. Wade, which he had relied on his accounting. That I think would have been addressed if counsel were retained to represent Ms. Ahern both in the compensatory judgment portion and the punitive portion, any evidence to rebut the contentions of Mr. Wade, because Judge Sturman herself, and we cited it in the transcript, that she had reservations about assessing punitive damages and how to do it, because there were gaps in the accounting, there were things that she couldn't determine whether it were intentionally done by Ms. Ahern or negligently or with malice or oppression. And there was this colloquy between counsel for the respondents and the judge during the closing argument, and that's kind of where we ended up with the problematic way they got to punitive damages, which, as common ground, counsel for the respondents suggested that they treble a cashier's check that was taken out of the trust by Ms. Ahern, which was ultimately given back to the trustee before the respondents filed their motion for damages. So if you look at the Bongiovi case, where it talks about the guidepost to determine whether a punitive damage award is unconstitutionally arbitrary or excessive, there's no relationship to the amount of that cashier's check to the actual compensatory damages.
What were the compensatory damages awarded? They were $2.2 million or something like that.
It was approximately $2.5, but then the court acknowledged the partial satisfaction of judgment, so the compensatory judgment as reflected in the order was about $1.7 million. But that $1.2 million check was not in the calculus for the $1.7 million compensatory.
Right, I understand that. It wasn't in play as a damage item because it was recovered.
Okay. And that really ties into the second argument. I've already discussed it a little bit, that under Bongiovi, the way that the court assessed punitive damages was completely arbitrary because it was based on a check that wasn't part of the compensatory judgment and it had no relationship. So if you look at, for example, the ratio of the harm inflicted as a result of the check versus the compensatory judgment, you're at a zero to $3.6 million ratio, and that shocks the conscience. So we believe that in addition to the statutory procedure not being followed, the way that punitive damages calculated was arbitrary and should be remanded.
Okay. Can you address the continuance motion and give us a timeline?
Yes. So we have to go back to November of 2016 because that's when Ms. Ahern's prior counsel, Mr. Leonard, filed his motion to withdraw an order shortening time. It was heard 2 days after he filed the motion. Mr. Semenza presented. He didn't make a formal appearance. And during that time, I think moments before the motion was heard, Ms. Ahern submitted a fax ex parte asking a request that fees be paid because Mr. Leonard was going to be withdrawing. And Judge Sterman acknowledged on the record that she thought Ms. Ahern, given the situation, needed counsel. And I believe Judge Sterman was trying to do the right thing. I think she had good intentions. But the structure that she set up to get counsel appointed, although it might have made sense in a vacuum, it didn't make sense in the real world. Because what she wanted is she wanted Ms. Ahern to engage in an agreement with a lawyer, have that lawyer file a notice of appearance, and then submit a fee budget that the trustee and the court could look at to determine whether it was a reasonable budget. The problem with that, Your Honor, is that if an attorney enters a notice of appearance in a case, he's in that case. And if for whatever reason the budget isn't approved, he's got to file a motion to withdraw, and then you're back to square one.
So you're saying it's a cart before the horse?
Yes, I do. Because I think Judge Sterman got it right the day before the evidentiary hearing where she said, trustees directed to pay Mr. Semenza a reasonable attorney fee, and then you could, you know, fight that later and take a haircut later. But that was a day before the hearing was set to commence.
And the time frame to be clear, because we have first hearing, second hearing, and no bifurcated, it's confusing a bit, but the motion to withdraw was in mid-November, then
yes.
There was a deposition, then you get December, and there's no hearing. When was the hearing set? When did the trustee give the report back to the judge that led the judge to set the February 8th hearing?
You know, without the record before me, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I do know that
February 1st, isn't it?
Yeah, so I mean, there was very short time notice on that hearing. It was my impression on the record.
The actual hearing was, I believe, February 9th and 10th. The motion withdrawal was heard on November 23rd.
But when was the February 9th and 10th hearing set? And if you don't know, could you look it up?
I don't know, but I could look it up.
Thank you.
Do you want me to do that now or do you want me to?
No.
Okay.
You can file a supplement after argument if you don't.
Thank you. Is that my
You're time? You're in your rebuttal time.
Okay. Then I will hold off for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justice Pickering. May it please the court, Joey Powell, appearing on behalf of the respondents. Context is everything in life, and context is everything in this particular case. I say that because this was not a civil case. This was a probate case. This was a case that was in front of a sole trier of fact in Judge Sterman. Judge Sterman is a well-experienced judge. She knows what she's doing. But what's important in this case is that she heard everything in this case. She knew everything about everything. She had heard every fact. She had heard every piece of evidence. She had heard every defense. She had heard every argument. Before she had actually computed the punitive damages award, she had been the judge on this matter for 4.5 years. What Judge Sterman did is she applied the facts to the law and rendered a ruling that punitive damages should apply here in the amount of $3.6 million.
Let me pause you there, because it is there's also a notice to litigants issue, whether you're in probate or regular civil court, and a statutory requirement of a bifurcated hearing. It's a bit troubling looking at this record. And I was asking your friend across the aisle on when the hearing was noticed and how much lead time did his client get of that hearing. It looked to me like she got about 10 days notice that she was on trial for imposition of punitives and determination of amount. Am I wrong in that?
I respectfully would assert you are wrong in that, Justice Pickering.
Okay, tell me what the
sure.
time frame is.
Sure, I'd love to explain this. We have to go back to 2015 for the proper context of this. June 3rd, 2015, the respondents filed what we termed in our brief the surcharge petition. The surcharge petition asked for Ms. Ahern to be disinherited from the trust, the no contest clause enforced. It asked for punitive damages. It also asked for treble damages.
Right. We have had the no contest clause piece of this case before.
Correct. Correct, Justice. Yes. So from there, and this goes to the purpose of the statute that's in play here, 42005 subpart 3. The key part of that statute is to ensure that there is notice given that punitive damages are being sought against the defendant. And that's what occurred here. Ms. Ahern knew going back to 2015 and the filing of that surcharge petition that punitive damages were being requested here, which is the first component of the statute. Knowing that someone is asking for punitive damages to be imposed against you for your conduct.
Yeah, I know the pleadings framed it. What I'm getting at that's a bit troubling is she doesn't have counsel in November, and she said she'd like counsel, but she needs money to do it.
Well, so, Justice, if I can proceed to explain. So what resulted from that surcharge petition was the preliminary evidentiary hearing on all those issues. And at that hearing, the conclusion of that on March 3rd was the determination that punishment was coming for Ms. Ahern. That was not in dispute. And I can cite to the record, Justices, on that to explain that to you. Judge Sturman stated, and I'll cite to the record here, in volume 4, page 390, I think this is punitive damage time. I do. No trustee should be allowed to behave this way without consequences. She says on page 395, I think the conduct rises to punitive damages.
But in her order, though, after that initial hearing in 2016, she said that the subsequent evidentiary hearing, whenever that happened after completion of the accounting, would be when she would decide whether to impose punitive damages and how much, right?
I would respectfully disagree slightly with your statement, Justice Kadish. Mm-hmm. What the context of that in the order, and keep in mind if we go back to looking at the statute simply requires a finding. It doesn't require an order. There was a finding made by Judge Sturman on the bench. The record, there's numerous statements that Judge Sturman made findings from the bench as in regard to punitive damages applying. But the context of what she was saying in the order was, and I'll quote from the order, she said, Ms. Ahern's conduct was shocking and needs to be dealt with in a serious fashion. What Judge Sturman was deciding at that point was whether we were going to be doing punitive damages, treble damages, or a combination of both. She actually states that in the record. So in regard to the order...
Well, but even you at the second hearing were urging the court to award punitive damages. In other words, even you were not saying they were a foregone conclusion that there would be any punitive damages awarded. That second hearing appears to litigate both.
I going by Judge Sturman's declarations, she also says in regards to, again, that second hearing that you referenced, Justice, she says on March 3rd, the 2016 hearing, the preliminary hearing, she says, and I quote from volume 4, page 391, the damage phase needs to go forward. What has to be understood and kept in mind here was that there was the possibility that there was actually more theft of funds than was originally believed by Mr. Wade. Mr. Wade submitted a report in 2015, I believe it was July, in which he had his preliminary findings of what his investigation revealed. But through the course of the matter, it was believed by Mr. Wade that there could actually be more money that was out there that was not accounted for. The problem that Mr. Wade had throughout this entire matter was that he could never get Ms. Ahern's cooperation, explanations, all of this. So he had to do this on his own. What Judge Sturman was indicating into the, as to the damages was she couldn't set an amount of damages because she didn't know the full extent of the damages. Ultimately, it wound up being that Mr. Wade's first report effectively was very close to his final report. So that was the context of what was going on here.
So the order Judge Sturman entered, which was filed September 19, 2016, says Ms. Ahern's conduct was shocking and needs to be dealt with in a serious fashion. I'm on page 411 going on to 412.
Mm-hmm.
But the final decision on whether punitive and or treble damages should be awarded in addition to restitution will be made at the evidentiary hearing to be scheduled after Mr. Wade concludes discovery and prepares his report and accounting to the court. So doesn't that indicate, yes, she's obviously concerned about what she's seeing, but there isn't a final decision yet on whether punitive damages are appropriate?
I believe, again, it's the context of not yet deciding whether or not it was going to be only punitive damages, it was only going to be the trebling of damages, or it was going to be a combination of both. And Judge Sturman says that on the record. So that's the context of what that order is. Now, I would fully agree, could the order have been more clear? Yes. But was it? Did it contain what it needed to contain? Yes. And going back and looking again at Judge Sturman's findings from the bench, she clearly says, I'm going to punish you, Ms. Ahern. I just don't know the full extent of what that punishment is going to be, which is, leads her to say again, we need to have the damage phase, which is the second prong, the requirement of the statute that's in play.
When was the February 9th and 10th hearing set?
That must have been set, by my recollection, 6-7 months out, when Mr. Leonard was still representing Ms. Ahern at the time. Mr. Leonard withdrew because he felt he could no longer adequately represent Ms. Ahern.
Right.
And that's what he stated. Judge Sturman was very clear when Mr. Semenza appeared at that withdrawal hearing. Judge Sturman very clearly stated to him, I'm happy to provide funds to you. All you need to do is submit a litigation budget to me. I've done it in the past for Mr. Leonard, and I'll be happy to do it for you too. That never came. Ms. Ahern, at the last minute, the eve before the February 9th, 2017 hearing, submitted a fax to Judge Sturman and said, I now want funds for my attorney. Well, 3 months before, Judge Sturman, with Mr. Semenza present, said, please, submit your budget.
Right. So you would argue then that she did not abuse her discretion by declining to continue the hearing at that late date?
No, Justice. What occurred here was not even prejudice. What it was is this was a consequence of Ms. Ahern's actions. And Ms. Ahern, at the end of the day, is the one that chose to wait to the eve of trial on the damages phase before asking for what Judge Sturman had indicated 3 months prior to Mr. Semenza. Happy to have you represent her. Just let me know what funds you need from the trust, and I'll consider that.
Did Ms. Ahern or any of her prior counsel argue in district court that she needed, that she wanted 42005 complied with so she would be able to put on a case that she had no money and therefore punitive damages should take into account her relatively impoverished state, after the damage award was put in place? I mean,
yeah, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question for me?
It's sort of an inarticulate question, but I don't see anything in this record where she said, I need extra time to prepare for the assessment of the determination of amount of punitive damages, other than the motion to continue to get counsel.
Correct, Your Honor. She had wanted Mr. Semenza again to represent her. Judge Sturman actually said, that's fine, Mr. Semenza, you will get paid from the trust. Actually, the morning of that February 9th hearing, Mr. Semenza showed up. It was Mr. Semenza's decision at that time, though, to simply say, I don't think I actually want to go forward with this.
And was she appearing by video at that hearing?
Yes, Justice. She actually made the willful decision not to physically be present at the hearing. Okay. She did not want to participate. And she wanted to just be video conferenced in.
So I just want, following up on Justice Pickering's question then, I just want to be clear. Did she ask for additional time to be able to present information about her financial status to support her position that there shouldn't be punitive damages or it should be a smaller amount?
No, Justice, and where this goes to is the context as well, is that Judge Sturman had already known about Ms. Ahern's finances because that had become part of the case earlier.
Right.
And so Ms. Ahern's finances had already been well known by Judge Sturman substantially before Judge Sturman actually calculated the damages. And the other key distinction here as well is that Ms. Ahern's personal finances were never at risk here. It was always going to be just from the share of the trust.
Well, where do you get that? Because our decision in on the no contest clause piece of this, I mean, if she violated the no contest clause, if your side had won that argument, mm-hmm. and she would lost all interest as a beneficiary of the trust, we decided that September of 2018. So you wouldn't have known whether she had any assets outside these trusts earlier, right?
Well, we did know based on the fact that as I mentioned to Justice Gatish, that was already substantially before her personal financial situation had already been part of the picture because Judge Sturman had suspended her share with the understanding that Ms. Ahern could come to the court and effectively have funds released based on need. So Ms. Ahern's financial position was already well known ahead of time.
I mean, whatever money might have been used for counsel, they were talking about releasing trust funds for that.
Yes.
But this award of punitive damages obviously is against her personal assets, not trust assets, or am I missing something?
You are, Justice. Yes, it was always understood that this was going to be against the trust,
her share of
the trust, not her personal assets, correct?
Where do you get that from? Because, like, punitive damages are not dischargeable. Mm-hmm. Where do you get that they weren't to be imposed personally?
The request was always to have, the request of the respondents was always to have it from her share.
And there would have been sufficient amounts in her share of the trust or what had been her share of the trust to satisfy that amount?
Yes.
Assuming that you lost on the no contest issue.
Yes.
Otherwise, it would have been a personal...
She wouldn't get anything from the trust.
Yes. And that would have then would have not been pursued effectively.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
You have 2 minutes and 53 seconds for rebuttal. A wise use of your time.
I'll do my best. To start off with, respondents referred to certain statements that Judge Sturman made at the first evidentiary hearing. And if you look at the record, she went all over the place on what she was saying. But as we cited in our reply brief, under the Division of Child and Family Services case from 2004, a court's oral pronouncements, clerk's minute orders, that's ineffective for any purpose. What we got to rely on is the order. And as Justice Cates,
It's okay. It's still new.
correctly pointed out that, you know, the order at issue is clear and unambiguous. And paragraph 8 of that order says, the final decision on whether punitive damages or treble damages should be awarded in addition to restitution will be made at the evidentiary hearing to be scheduled after Mr. Wade conducts his discovery and prepares his report. I don't think that a litigant can waive their right to have a subsequent proceeding under the statute as suggested by the respondents, especially considering that we have a pro se litigant here, where this court has noted that even though pro se litigants are held to the same rules, district courts are required to be flexible with them. And also considering that in that order,
Ms. Ahern could rely on it. She could rely on the order where it said that the assessment of punitive damages would be at the later date and the determination at a later date, and rely on the fact that there could have been a subsequent hearing.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
I think about August, after the hearing in February, Judge Sturman appointed a guardian.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, was there any concern back in February during the hearings that there may be an issue there?
There was nothing that was expressly stated in the hearing, but what we do have in the record is there was a supplement to the motion filed by respondents where they went through this extensive factual history where they brought up issues of possible exerting undue influence over Ms. Ahern and just her doing erratic things. We have the fact that, you know, she appeared via video teleconference, but it was pretty clear that she was having issues, understanding, asking for questions to be repeated. And then we had this elephant in the room where less than 6 months later, the court appoints the guardian ad litem. So it begs the question, and this is where we look at abuse of discretion on, I think, on the denial of motion to continuance. Looking at all the facts here, we have a situation where this case only involved one witness who was a court-appointed trustee who was under the supervision of the court, where there was an income stream of money that was subject to the trustee's control, so there was no concern of the money being dissipated anymore. We had a pro se litigant against a substantial punitive damage threat and compensatory damage threat. And when you look at the prejudices, it would not have been prejudicial for the respondents to have that hearing continued so that Ms. Ahern could get counsel. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I would ask that you either jointly or separately submit when this February 9th hearing was set, because it matters in my thinking on the case, and I couldn't readily find it. The order that we were referring to as Record 411 talks about we're going to set this hearing after the trustee files his report. So, you know, there may have been some status date set, but it would seem to me there's an order that sets this for hearing, and I would like to know when that was.
Absolutely.
And if you two can do it jointly, that would be wonderful. If you have different versions of it, submit them separately, but please get that to us in the next week if you could.
Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This matter will stand submitted and will be at ease while the case that follows, counsel for it come forward.